Having a job to do, causing an increased effort to wake, is so important in understanding and treating confusional events in children that we will return to it in more detail shortly. Sensory stimulation. Noises, lights, and other kinds of sensory stimulation can easily strengthen the drive to wake, since they signal a change in the environment that might warrant investigation. If they disturb a child during or at the end of a period of stage 4 sleep, the additional drive to wake up can lead to a confusional event. In the laboratory, a loud buzzer set off an hour after sleep begins can trigger a sleep terror in susceptible children. Lower levels of stimulation can have the same effect at home. Your child may sit up and scream when you make noise climbing the stairs, for instance, or if you cover her with a blanket near the end of her cycle of deep sleep. Even children who don't ordinarily sleepwalk can often be induced to do so at the end of a stage 4 period simply by lifting them up and setting them on their feet. Factors that can strengthen either drive. Inconsistent and chaotic sleep-wake schedules. The drives to stay asleep and to wake are controlled in large part by our biological rhythms. Refer to Chapter 9. When we travel, jet lag can cause our bodies to get confused. These rhythms are no longer rising and falling together at predictable times, and the relative timing of the sleep and wake drives may be affected. As a result, our bodies get mixed messages from different physiological systems, some saying to wake and others saying to sleep. The same thing can happen to a child on a variable schedule. As a cause of partial wakings at night, this phenomenon is particularly important in young children. Day-to-day changes in bedtimes, waking times, or the number or timing of naps can throw a child's underlying biological rhythms out of sync. Her drive to wake may be increased at a time when she should be sleeping, or her drive to sleep may be increased when she should be awake. Thus, for example, the internal signal to wake and end the night's first sleep cycle may come before that cycle is really done, while the drive to sleep is still very strong, and a confusional event becomes more likely. Sleep disruption, illness, and medication. Illness and medication affect the waking and sleeping drives in complex ways. Many illnesses and the side effects of some medications directly affect the body in ways that increase sleepiness. On the other hand, the side effects of other medications stimulate the drive to wake up, and some illnesses and sleep disorders, like sleep apnea, do the same, either directly or by causing pain or discomfort that wakes the child. For instance, a sick child may wake at night because of throat pain or a dry mouth. This tendency toward waking leaves a child's sleep disrupted, broken, or fragmented, and that loss of sleep in turn increases her drive to sleep as well. Not surprisingly, some children experience confusional events only when running a fever, when sick, with or without a fever, or when taking medication that affects sleep or the ability to wake. Other causes of confusional events. Inherited characteristics. Some children who experience confusional events at night have close relatives with a similar history. We do not know what traits these children inherited. It may be that family members simply tend to sleep more deeply than most, or that they have a stronger inherent biological drive to wake between sleep cycles. In some children, inherited characteristics by themselves appear to account completely for the confusional events. In others, they may only be predisposing factors. These characteristics might explain why only some children with jobs to do during the night walk, thrash, talk, or yell in their sleep. Genetic factors may also partially determine the specific type of arousal shown by a child, That is, where on the spectrum of intensity they occur, from sleep-talking to terrors. Other biological factors. In a small group of children, frequent arousal events persist at night even after we have dealt with all identifiable causes. In some of these youngsters, non-REM sleep is continually broken by small arousals that are identifiable only with special monitoring, like that done during an overnight study in a sleep laboratory. You would not see them just by watching your child sleep at home. These children's sleep patterns seem to be inherently unstable, although we do not yet know the biological factors responsible. Although their nighttime arousals may be resistant to behavioral treatments, they still usually respond well to medication. The significance of having a job to do at night. The problems facing a child with a job to do at night should be largely familiar to you from the chapters on associations, feedings, limits, and fears. For example, if a child starting to wake after a sleep cycle finds that the conditions associated with falling asleep have changed, or she has learned that they frequently do, she will try to wake fully to check, and if necessary, to try to get the previous conditions reestablished. She may find she is in a different room, that her parents are no longer sitting on her bed, that the rocking has stopped or the pacifier has fallen out, or that it is time for her to change to another bed. If she starts to wake during the night at a time when she is used to eating, she will try to wake fully to ask to be fed. If she spends an hour testing limits by repeatedly calling and coming out of her room before she falls asleep, she will pick up where she left off and start doing the same thing when she starts to wake. In each of these scenarios, the child has a job of some kind to do, some situation that requires her full attention, and she must wake up to do it. She can't simply slide into the next sleep cycle after a brief brush with the waking state, as she should. You may well have experienced this kind of thing yourself. If you have to get up early, but your alarm clock is broken, for instance, you may find that you awaken completely several times during the night to check the time, whereas ordinarily you would just stir slightly and go right back to sleep. Having jobs to do during the night is not good for sleep. They greatly strengthen a child's drive to wake, and as we've seen, that may lead to confusional events. Consider a child who will only go to sleep at bedtime if her father is sitting in the room. Instead of falling asleep quickly, she keeps checking to be sure he is still there and to go and find him if he isn't. Suppose she wakes every night at 2 a.m, checks for her father, and, finding him gone, goes after him. Then she gets into her parents' bed, where she sleeps the rest of the night. She can switch rooms without trouble, because at that hour she is waking from fairly light sleep. Now suppose that one night she tries to do the same thing when she starts to wake at the end of her first sleep cycle, at 11 o'clock, after only 2 hours of sleep. The pattern of room switching may have become so automatic that she tries to leave her bed and head for her parents' room before she is fully awake. Her habitual response is to try to become more alert and switch rooms, that is, her drive to wake is strong. But at this time of night her sleep is very deep, much deeper than at her usual 2 o'clock waking. It may be so deep that she cannot wake fully enough even to realize why she is struggling to get up. The conflict between her waking and sleeping systems produces a partial arousal, a confusional event. Exactly what she does may depend upon the strength of the sleep system when she tries to wake. If she is almost able to wake, she may still get to her parents' room, but now by walking in her sleep. It may even be hard to tell if she is asleep but almost awake, or awake but almost asleep, although this distinction is probably meaningless anyway, since in both cases sleep and wake systems are active simultaneously. If the balance is closer to sleep, she may remain in bed but cry and thrash about, or she may be able to get out of bed and sleepwalk, but in an upset or very confused manner, heading off in the wrong direction. She is too asleep to know why she is trying to get up. If she did not have this job to do during the night, she would simply slide back into sleep and the confusional event would not happen. As this example illustrates, confusional events commonly occur only at a child's first or second waking at night. Later in the night, she will be waking from lighter sleep, so those wakings are likely to be more complete. However, patterns and habits learned at these later, fuller wakings, like this girl's need to check for her father, or another child's habit of calling to have her back rubbed, are often behind the confusional arousals that occur earlier in the night, especially in toddlers and young children of school age. In these situations, a single problem, that of improper behavior patterns and habits, shows up in different ways at different times of night, as full wakings with specific requests or demands in the middle and the end of the night, and as confusional events early on. At the end of a confusional event triggered in this way, the child's job remains undone, so it is not uncommon for both types of behavior to appear in a single waking. The waking starts as a confusional event, recognizable because the child's thrashing about seems to have no purpose, and because she doesn't respond well to attempts to help. But when she wakes at the end of the episode, she does not go right back to sleep, as most children do after even intense events. Instead, because she still has the job to do, she may force herself into fuller alertness. From that point forward, she is completely awake, and her behavior may now clearly reflect learned habits and associations of the kind discussed in earlier chapters. The specific jobs a child can have to do at night vary with age and with factors such as sleeping arrangements, patterns of parental response, recent events, and current concerns. School-age children typically have different jobs to do than do toddlers. An 8-year-old child who is trying not to wet the bed may have a strong impulse to wake fully, get up, and use the bathroom each time she stirs. And a 10-year-old girl who frequently hears her parents fighting at night may feel the need to wake and listen to be sure they are okay. Also, an older child who is frequently carried to bed after falling asleep in the living room may need to check which room she is in each time she starts to wake, in the same way that a toddler often must do. Once a behavior pattern of this sort has been established, it can persist out of habit in sleep, even after it ceases to serve a purpose and is no longer reinforced by full waking behavior. A child who no longer moves to her parents' room at night when she is fully awake may still walk there or elsewhere in her sleep, effectively on autopilot. In a sense, this habit still functions as a job to do, even though the job no longer really needs doing. She just can't wake fully enough to remember that. During middle childhood and into adolescence, children may develop another type of job to do at night, that of controlling their own urges and thoughts. Many people find it easy to keep unpleasant feelings in check during the day when they are wide awake and fully alert, but not so easy when they are asleep and dreaming, drowsy and daydreaming, or just waking up. As you wake from deep sleep, you are not in full control of your thoughts and behavior. If for any reason it is important to you to regain control quickly, then you may try to become fully alert as soon as possible. As we have seen, that struggle can, at least in a child, be enough to trigger a confusional event. For example, some children keep their behavior carefully controlled during the day. When such well-behaved children start to wake at night, they may instinctively work to regain the self-control they gave up during sleep. This task requires the child's attention and effectively strengthens the drive to wake, which in turn also makes partial arousal events more likely. Such well-controlled children are typically pleasant to be with and easy for a teacher to have in class. This tendency toward control is often just a personality style, but it can become a problem if carried to excess. Some children, for example, choose to keep any feelings they might consider negative, such as anger, jealousy, and guilt, inside and unexpressed. Others do so only in class, but feel freer to show their emotions at home. Most children put extra checks on their behavior at the start of a school year, particularly if they have a new teacher. Probably for this reason, confusional events are especially common in September and October. Interestingly, whereas school-age children who frequently sleepwalk or have confusional arousals tend to be the well-behaved type, children with frequent nightmares are more likely to be ones who act out their feelings and have trouble controlling their behavior during the day. Anxieties and other concerns may also be associated with a need for control and an attempt to wake fully during the night. If you go to sleep after lying awake for a long time, troubled by anxieties, for example, you may wake fully and start worrying again whenever you stir at night, instead of just turning over and returning to sleep. Similarly, if an anxious child lies in bed frightened for a long time at bedtime, struggling to avoid certain thoughts or behaviors as she goes to sleep, she may try to wake fully enough to get the same control over those thoughts and actions whenever she stirs during the night. If this occurs on waking from deep sleep, then despite her efforts, she may be unable to wake fully. Children may also find themselves reacting to situations outside of their control, a move to a new neighborhood, a transfer to a new school, or especially a personal loss such as a divorce, separation, or death in the family. Even an intact family can lack warmth, love, and nurturance. Parents may be rigid, demanding, and uncompromising, setting unrealistically high expectations for their child's behavior, school performance, and athletic success. Older children in such situations are often angry, but unlike most toddlers, they may choose to keep their anger locked up, probably in a belief that expressing their feelings would only lead to more unpleasantness. A child may blame herself for her parents' separation or for other family problems, and she may carefully avoid giving her parents any reason for displeasure. Such a child is likely to act extremely pleasant and well-behaved, if anything too well-behaved. Occasionally, her anger will show in passive ways that seem safer to her. She may stay in her room after school and keep silent at mealtimes, or she may not do as well in school as she could. She expends enormous quantities of energy during the day, guarding her emotions and keeping them in check. But at night, in sleep, these defenses must be relaxed. Whenever she starts to wake, she senses this loss of control and tries to wake more fully to get it back. This job can easily be enough to cause a confusional event. To get a better idea of how a child's emotional state at bedtime can alter her reaction to a normal partial arousal and turn a routine end-of-sleep cycle waking into a confusional event, think about how your own state of mind can affect your reaction to a stimulus while you're awake. Imagine that you are nervously walking through an old cemetery, alone, on a dark night, when suddenly you hear a twig snap. You will probably jump or cry out in fear. You might even run away without ever learning whether there was really anything to be afraid of. If you heard the same twig break at home in the light of day, it might not startle you at all. But alone in the cemetery, you are already jumpy and on your guard. Your state of mind determined your response to the noise. The analogy isn't perfect because in this example you are awake and relatively clear-headed. But the same idea applies during sleep. If a twig breaks outside your window while you're comfortably asleep in your own bed, You probably won't be aware of it, and if it wakes you at all, you will not consider the noise important, and you'll immediately return to sleep. But if for some reason you were sleeping in that cemetery, or on a battlefield where an attack could come at any time, the same sound of a snapping twig might awaken you instantly in a panic. Confused and terrified, you might jump up and even cry out, as a child having a sleep terror does. But it's not the noise of the twig that made you scream, or even finding yourself in the cemetery or on the battlefield, since you reacted before you had a chance to see or remember where you were. Rather, it was the anxieties that you went to sleep with in the first place that gave the snapping twig significance and caused you to have an increased need to wake to check to see that you were still safe. Going to sleep in the cemetery or on the battlefield, you knew you were letting down your guard in threatening surroundings, and as a result, your drive to wake and thus your response to the noise is much greater. Your psychological state at the time of falling asleep made the difference. The causes of calm sleepwalking are similar to those of sleep terrors, but the need to wake may not be so urgent. Think of going to sleep with the window open on a night when thunderstorms are predicted. If a storm starts, the sound of thunder and rain, which ordinarily would barely interrupt your sleep, will trigger a strong impulse to wake up, but only because you knew the window was open. If you are deeply asleep at that moment, you won't be able to wake fully right away, and you may be too confused at first to remember what exactly you needed to do. For a short while, wandering about befuddled and unsure why you are up, you will be feeling something much like what your child feels when she walks in her sleep. The same phenomenon is true for children. Any child who goes to bed at night knowing she will have to try to wake later because she has a job to do, whether to check for change or danger or to complete a simple habit or task, may be prone to sleepwalking, confusional arousals, and sleep terrors. The solution for these children is, if possible, to take away the jobs that are driving these children to wake up, and to help them learn to relax their guard when they go to sleep, so that they can take normal nighttime arousals in stride. We will return to this idea later in this chapter when we consider treatment methods. The variability of arousals over time. The intensity of confusional events can be mild, restlessness, sleep talking, mumbling, moderate, thrashing in bed, sleepwalking, yelling, or severe, wild screaming, appearance of panic, or marked agitation, running. They can be very brief in duration, several minutes at most, short, 5 to 20 minutes, or long, up to an hour, and they can occur only occasionally, no more than once every few weeks, commonly, up to once a week, or frequently, several times per week, even nightly. A child's nighttime arousals may differ from night to night, month to month, or year to year. They may progress in either direction along the continuum, ranging from quiet arousals to major sleep terrors, becoming either more or less severe. But day-to-day changes in a child's life can be subtle and difficult to recognize, and the occurrence and intensity of arousals may change from night to night without any apparent changes in the child's daytime activities or stresses. In fact, symptoms usually wax and wane over weeks and months without any evident psychological or physiological reasons. Therefore, it is not easy to predict on which nights a child's confusional events will occur based only on knowledge of what is currently happening in her life, even when that includes major events such as an upcoming examination, an operation, a soccer game, or a separation from the family. The main exception is that confusional events are much more common in toddlers when they are overtired. It's also possible for daytime changes to affect the pattern of confusional arousals in unexpected ways. For example, if your child's partial arousals are caused in part by a need to keep her thoughts and behavior tightly controlled, then an apparent change for the worse in her daytime behavior may actually be associated with a reduction in the frequency of these nighttime arousals. Because she is allowing herself to express more of her feelings in the daytime, even if inappropriately, she might feel less of a need to guard against them at night. Evaluating confusional events. When to take action. In deciding how significant your child's partial wakings are, and whether you should do anything about them, there are several factors to think about. Your child's age, the frequency, length, and intensity of the episodes, the extent to which they disrupt other family members' sleep, including yours, what social consequences they may have at camp or sleepovers, for example, the risk of injury, any identifiable triggers, such as being overtired or starting a new school year, and any self-imposed or external psychological stressors. As you evaluate your child's symptoms, consider the possible causes described in this chapter, but remember that you may well be unable to find a good explanation for any particular episode. Without any treatment, the typical confusional arousals of a toddler will usually be outgrown by age 5 or 6. Emotional factors are rarely the cause during these early years, but if they seem to be, for example, if the episode's onset coincides with a significant event, such as a divorce, a death in the family, or a family member's hospitalization, then you may want to consider professional consultation. However, other causes of partial wakings are more common at these ages. Jobs to do at night, a regular schedule becoming irregular, being overtired, and these are most often straightforward to treat. When partial waking episodes begin in or persist into middle childhood or adolescence, their significance, causes, and course may be different. For example, psychological style and other emotional factors are more likely to be relevant in an older child, especially if the partial waking events are frequent. Partial wakings with these causes usually can be treated successfully, but if left untreated, it's impossible to say when they will stop. Events that are mild and brief are probably of little importance, even if they happen frequently, and they generally need no treatment. Even moderately intense events, regardless of whether they are short or long-lasting, are probably unimportant if they occur only occasionally. But moderately intense events that happen more frequently should be considered significant enough to at least consider treatment. So should more severe events, even if they happen only occasionally. You should also consider treating any events an older child finds embarrassing, particularly if social decisions such as attending sleepovers and camp are affected. Keep the context in mind. If confusional episodes happen only when your child is overtired or febrile, they are probably of little concern, especially if the child is young and the episodes are relatively mild. In older children, episodes that happen only at times of temporary anxiety, such as exams or the start of the school year, should probably not worry you either. If the problem does appear to require treatment and you cannot solve it yourself, you should consult your doctor. You should probably also discuss with your doctor any events that are extremely frequent, very long-lasting, or very intense, especially if they pose any danger to your child or other family members. Don't hesitate to contact your doctor, even if you are simply feeling uncertain or worried about what is happening. In very rare cases, medical or neurological problems may be involved. For example, pain from heartburn or ear disease may be triggering the events, or seizures may be causing them, or being mistaken for them. Be particularly suspicious and always seek medical advice if your child's episodes are significantly different in character from those described in this chapter. for example, if they occur near morning instead of closer to bedtime. If the episodes are always exactly the same, if your child wakes fully just before the beginning of the episode rather than only at the end, and knows that something unpleasant is about to occur, if she clearly remembers the entire event or its beginning, if her body stiffens and consistently takes on an asymmetrical posture, such as with her left arm extended and her head turned to the left, or if her body jerks prominently and repetitively during the episodes. Keep in mind that most normal toddlers occasionally have confusional arousals of varying intensity. It is not known how many children have extended thrashing spells, sleepwalking, and full sleep terrors, but at least 15% of all children sleepwalk at least once, and extended confusional arousals probably occur in far more children than that. Of course, the number of these children whose episodes are very frequent and intense is smaller, but occasional wild sleep terrors, where the child runs about in apparent panic, are by no means rare. If your child is a toddler, you may want to see if you can eliminate her confusional events using the methods described in the discussion that follows, even if the events are not particularly troublesome or worrisome. It is often easy to identify and treat the causes in toddlers. With older children, you need to consider psychological factors as well as the actual symptoms in deciding whether or not to seek treatment. But take care not to be too quick to ascribe a serious psychological significance to your child's particular nighttime partial arousals. In a happy, socially active, academically successful youngster, the episodes may only reflect the child's style of controlled behavior and thought, which is not necessarily a sign of trouble. If nothing else points to an ongoing problem, there is probably no need to seek psychological counseling. The best guide is to assess your child's psychological well-being in the daytime. If she is having emotional problems in general, she may benefit from psychological help, and if she is also sleepwalking or having sleep terrors at night, it may help with those too. Bear in mind, however, that significant progress in psychotherapy may not produce an immediate improvement at night. Don't judge therapeutic success by, say, how far your child walks in her sleep at night. As you judge your child's emotional condition, don't place too much weight on things she says while sleep-talking or during other confusional events. The things children say during agitated partial arousals, most commonly, "no, no," are automatic vocalizations triggered in low-level areas of the brain, not in the areas that control waking thought. Don't let them worry you. They do not reflect subconscious or deep-seated fears or urges. You can even ignore violent or alarming speech, such as "kill him" or "I want to die," if she is mostly asleep when she says such things. Do, however, pay attention to what she says when awake. If she is truly depressed, anxious, or suffering from another emotional disturbance, it will show in her waking life, not just when she's in a semi-waking, confused state. Because often neither parents nor children discuss these sleep episodes with friends, they are likely to think of the episodes and the child herself as strange or abnormal. You should recognize by now that these behaviors are, in fact, common, and that, even without help, preschoolers at least will probably outgrow them on their own. 2. Treatment. What you should do and what else to consider. Most treatment approaches used with young children are not only benign in themselves, but also good sleep hygiene practices in general. Applying them is a good idea, even if they don't entirely solve the problem of partial wakings. As you begin to determine what to do about your child's partial arousals, first try to identify any factors that make it harder for her to wake out of deep sleep or that make a full waking more urgent. then eliminate these factors, if possible, or at least minimize them. Having done that, you will probably find that the arousals disappear, or at least become milder, shorter, and less frequent. Even if they continue, you have at least prepared the way for other techniques. Depending upon your youngster's age and the details of her problem, you will likely need to use one or more of the following approaches. Specific techniques for dealing with many of these individual issues are also discussed in depth in other chapters. General advice: ensure adequate sleep. As we saw earlier, an overtired child will have more, not fewer, partial arousals because her increased need for deep sleep interferes with her ability to wake at the end of the first or second sleep cycle. For youngsters up to about age 6, and sometimes older children as well, simply ensuring that the child gets enough sleep at night may be the only intervention needed. For children younger than 3.5 or 4 years of age, continuing regular naps may be similarly important. Keep to a regular schedule. Try to keep bedtimes and nap times consistent and predictable. That will allow your child's biological rhythms to stabilize and work in harmony, so that the arousals at the end of the first and second sleep cycles will be timed appropriately, when deep sleep is ready to give way to a lighter state. Eliminate nighttime jobs and habits. Your child should have no need to wake fully between sleep cycles before going back to sleep. She should not have to call for something, to be rocked, have her back rubbed, or get fed, look for something, a parent or a pacifier, or check on her surroundings to determine what room she is in, for instance. She should not have to get out of bed to switch rooms, change beds, walk around, or check that you are home. Methods to accomplish these changes are discussed in chapters 4 through 7. Provide a pleasant, structured bedtime. Avoid bedtime activities that your child may try to resume on waking. When we wake during the night, we tend to feel and act as if it were still bedtime. If your child is occupied by any tasks at bedtime other than falling asleep, she may try to continue these activities as soon as she begins to wake up. Thus, it's important that bedtime be a happy time, without demands and struggles. A child should not start the night by fighting to stay awake or testing limits. Nor should she have to check that you are still rocking her and have not put her in bed or left the room. Otherwise, she will have an increased drive to wake up during the night. Set an appropriate bedtime, late enough for your child to fall asleep quickly. Setting bedtime at an appropriate time is important for the same reason. If a child has too much time to think, worry, or make demands before she falls asleep, then when she starts to wake, she may try to continue where she left off. If your initially chosen bedtime turns out to be too late, and you always have to wake her in the morning, you can gradually move the bedtime earlier, as long as she continues to fall asleep quickly. Make any necessary changes to keep your child safe. Children moving around at night may not be fully aware of their surroundings. Most negotiate stairways without trouble, but if your child sleepwalks, don't leave anything on the floor or stairs that she could slip on. If your child is young, you may need to install a gate at the top of the stairs, in the hall, or in her bedroom doorway. If she sleeps in a bunk bed, put her in the lower bunk. If she tries to leave the house while sleepwalking, put an extra chain lock high up on the outside doors. If necessary, you can buy inexpensive alarms to alert you if doors are open during the night. If your child walks to places other than your bedroom, you may want to attach a bell to her bedroom door or gate to notify you that she is up. Even a child who is old enough to open a gate by herself may benefit from one if she wants to stop sleepwalking. In order to open the gate, she has to stop and wake more fully, giving her a chance to realize what she is doing and to return to bed. Occasionally, you might have to lock windows, and, in extreme cases, glass windows can be replaced with plastic. Other treatments to consider. Try relaxation exercises. Progressive relaxation exercises have been used successfully by some children 7 years and older. Books on these techniques are readily available. In bed, before going to sleep, children practice relaxing the different regions of their body, one part after the other. Concentrating on relaxation rather than on active behavior at bedtime may diminish a child's drive to wake fully during nighttime arousals, since, again, at nighttime wakings, people tend to pick up what they were doing when they fell asleep. This practice will help her get right back to sleep instead of trying to wake up completely during the night. Consider counseling for emotional issues. A decision about counseling should be based on several factors. As explained previously, it's important to base your assessment mostly on the child's behavior during the day. Even frequent arousal events do not necessarily mean a child needs psychotherapy. But keep an open mind. If you are unsure, consultation with a mental health professional may help you decide. Bear in mind, too, that therapy is a means to identify and treat certain psychological problems, not a specific treatment for arousal events. Improvement in sleep often follows progress in therapy very slowly. It may take your child some time to learn new ways of dealing with difficult feelings so that she can go to bed without worrying about relaxing her emotional defenses in sleep. Try medication if necessary. Partial arousals in school-age children and adolescents are usually easy to control with medication. Its effect in younger children is less predictable. A small bedtime dose of clonazepam, Clonopin, a drug similar to diazepam, Valium, often works quite well, as do other related agents. If a small dose decreases the frequency and intensity of episodes, a slightly higher dose will probably eliminate them. However, nightly use of such agents in young children is generally not warranted. Even though the dose required is usually small, and thus the side effects are usually mild to non-existent, I typically recommend medication for children only if they seem at risk of injuring themselves, unlikely in younger children, or if their partial arousals are particularly frequent, long-lasting, intense, and disruptive, and only if other treatment measures were unsuccessful. Sometimes, once we have determined a dose that works satisfactorily, the child reserves its use for sleepovers, travel, and camp. A few children must use medication nightly for several years. It is not known just why this class of drugs is so effective, but they suppress physiological changes that usually accompany arousal, such as increases in heart rate and blood pressure, and they likely reduce the cognitive drive to wake, as well as by making a child less anxious or concerned about any job to do. Medication treats the symptom of partial wakings, but it usually does not cure the underlying problem, if there is one. However, occasionally, a treatment course of several weeks seems to interrupt a pattern and the events do not restart when the drug is stopped. What to do during an event? Let arousal episodes run their course. Once an arousal episode has begun, keep your distance, wait it out, and intervene as little as possible. When the arousal subsides, let your child return to sleep. During a partial arousal, parents often and understandably feel that they should do something. Unfortunately, except in very calm events, you will usually only make matters worse if you try to hold your child, restrain her, or even touch her while the episode progresses. She will not recognize you, even though she may be calling for you, and she is likely to react to any intervention as a threat or attack. If she squirms, twists away, pushes you, or hits you, your attempts to help will only make her more upset. Generally, no amount of stimulation will bring your child to full wakefulness, at least during a major confusional event. A parent who shakes a child and yells at her until she wakes fully may think he has finally succeeded in awakening her, but the truth is that the child woke on her own when the episode was over, and the extra stimulation may only have prolonged it. It is much better simply to watch your child, ensuring that she is safe, but otherwise letting the episode run its course. All episodes eventually end on their own fairly suddenly. You can learn to tell when your child reaches this point. She will begin to relax, then typically stretch and yawn. Soon she will be ready to return to sleep. You can help her back into bed or lay her back down, but don't do anything else. Remember, she is awake now, and you do not want to encourage full extended wakings by playing with her or engaging in long conversations, or it could become a habit. Even fully developed sleep terrors should be allowed to run their course, though you may have to step in if your child is about to hurt herself or others, or if she might damage the furniture or walls. If you must intervene, do so as gently as possible, and use as little physical restraint as you can. An attempt to restrain an agitated 17-year-old could end up with both of you getting hurt. A child who is less agitated during a partial waking may be easier to handle. This is especially true of a calm sleepwalker, who can often be redirected or even led back to bed, in contrast to an agitated sleepwalker who does not like to be touched and must calm down before you can direct her anywhere. Often, parents lead a sleepwalking child to the bathroom before directing her back to bed, on the typically inaccurate assumption that it was a need to urinate that got her up in the first place. That is not always wise. The frequent act of getting up to use the bathroom, even when there is no great need, may only further condition the child to try to wake up at that time. This attempt to wake can develop into such a habit that it actually becomes the cause of sleepwalking. In fact, sometimes a boy, less frequently a girl, will even get up on his own to urinate, but do so in the wrong place, most likely in the corner of the room or into a wastebasket or closet, as if he knows generally what he is trying to do, but is not fully aware of the specifics. Since most children past the age of toilet training do not need to use the bathroom at all during the night, consider not taking her to the bathroom unless she specifically asks to go, or unless you find that she inevitably wets the bed later if you don't. Keep calm. Control your own worries and curiosity. If you attempt to help your child through a confusional event and she pushes you aside, it may make you angry. If she thrashes wildly as if possessed, you may be frightened. Try to avoid these reactions. By now you understand what is happening during a partial waking, and you should be able to watch it without misinterpreting your child's actions or mistaking it for something more serious. Do your best not to overreact, and control the impulse to try to wake your child. When she wakes after the episode ends, don't question her about it. She will not remember the event anyway. Just let her go back to sleep. If she sees you upset at this time, she may only become upset herself, which can further disrupt her sleep. She may have difficulty returning to sleep and start to worry about having similar events in the future. She may also be embarrassed. She has been acting in a way that she has no control over and that her family may regard as bizarre. If so, she might become angry if you ask her about it. If her personality is of the tightly controlled type, she may already worry about losing control during the day, and the knowledge that she has been quite out of her own control during the night could cause her even more anxiety. increasing her worries at bedtime and possibly even leading to more arousal events. As a result, it's usually best simply to let your child's episodes pass without comment, unless she asks about them or is old enough to participate in decisions concerning psychotherapy and medication. How we help the children, described earlier. Now that we've covered the spectrum of nighttime arousals and seen how to understand and treat them, we can go back to the children described at the beginning of the chapter to take a closer look and see how their problems were resolved. Marcy was the 4-year-old girl who talked in her sleep and moved restlessly early in the night. She did not really have a significant problem, but her parents were worried that her sleep was not calm enough. They wanted to know for certain whether they should be doing something about it. Once I explained that Marcy's behavior was completely normal and just part of the pattern of sleep cycling across the night, they relaxed. There was nothing they needed to do. Lisa, 1.5, went to sleep easily at bedtime in her crib with her pacifier, but she would seem to wake several hours later, crying and thrashing. She looked more uncomfortable or frustrated than frightened. Her mother or father would pick her up and try to comfort her to no avail, and she wouldn't take her pacifier. Instead, she thrashed still more strongly, arching her back and kicking. At various times, her parents tried walking her, talking her, and shaking her in an attempt to wake her. On a few occasions, they tried cold compresses or even screamed at her. Eventually, after 10 to 30 minutes, Lisa would begin to quiet down, stretch and yawn, and her parents would find that they could finally wake her fully and reassure themselves that she was all right. At this point, she would take her pacifier and go back to sleep, usually until morning. Her parents would hear her stir several more times, but they would only have to go to her when she needed their help to find the pacifier. I explained to Lisa's parents that Lisa was not awake during these episodes, nor was she frightened or in pain. If she were, she would want to be held and would allow herself to be comforted. I told them to keep an eye on her during these spells, but not to do anything else unless she was awake and clearly wanted something. Once she stopped crying, they could help her lie down and cover her, but there was no need to wake her fully or to replace the pacifier if she hadn't missed it. They soon grew accustomed to letting her get through the episodes without intervening and without feeling guilty. I also suggested that they stop letting Lisa sleep with the pacifier in the first place. Even though she was better able than most children her age to replace it by herself in the middle of the night, she did have to wake enough to look for it, and that need was probably contributing to her partial arousals. She got used to the change within 3 nights, by which time she had even stopped asking for it at bedtime. Lisa's parents noticed 2 improvements almost immediately. Her partial wakings became shorter, and she began going right back to sleep after each episode, now that her parents were not trying to wake her. By the 2nd week, the wakings had ceased to be a problem. Most of the remaining ones were mild, with only a little whining and thrashing, and her parents didn't even find it necessary to go into her room. Most nights, they were no longer sure whether she even woke at all. After a few weeks more, the wakings had completely stopped. Noah, almost 3, was happy and well-behaved during the day, but he had been waking frequently at night for a year. At his 7:30 bedtime, he always stalled, running off, demanding extra stories, and running off again. Once it got late enough, he stayed in bed and fell asleep easily, but that usually didn't happen until 9 or 10 o'clock. 2 or 3 hours later, he would begin moaning and moving about, then screaming, crying, and sweating profusely. He would toss, turn, and thrash wildly, get caught on the sheets, and bump into the wall. He appeared confused, or, as his parents described him, out of it. He sometimes muttered intelligible phrases, I don't want to. Go away. But much of his speech could not be understood. To his parents' dismay, they were unable to comfort him. He did not seem to recognize them, and he would push them away, which sometimes made them angry. Still, they would keep calling his name and shaking him until the episode finally ended after 15 to 20 minutes. Then he would relax, stretch, yawn, and start returning to sleep. Sometimes he had another episode an hour or two later, but it was almost always shorter and less intense than the first. The rest of the night was usually quiet. Shortly before bringing Noah to see me, his parents had tried eliminating his nap in hopes of improving his nighttime sleep, but that had only made the wakings worse. Noah's partial wakings were similar to Lisa's, just more intense. He was bigger than Lisa, so his thrashing could be more violent, and as he was nearly 3, his failure to respond or to talk clearly during these events seemed stranger and more worrisome to his parents than it would have if he were younger. I explained the partial arousals to Noah's parents and gave them the same advice I gave Lisa's parents, recommending that they keep their distance during the arousals and let him go back to sleep without questioning him, although I suggested that they go into his room when he was having an episode just to be sure he didn't hurt himself. Now that they understood the events better, they got less upset, and his apparent rebuffs of their efforts to help no longer bothered them. There was room for improvement in other ways as well. It seemed to me that Noah was not getting enough sleep. He was falling asleep too late, at least on some nights, and the loss of his nap was not helping. If he was overtired, it would make partial arousals more likely. I was also concerned by his constant attempts to find new ways of putting off going to bed, because I suspected that he was trying to resume that behavior when he began to wake, worsening the problem. At my suggestion, his parents reinstated the nap and put him on a later but firmly controlled bedtime schedule. We set 8:45 as the time for a story, and they were to say good night at 9. I helped them learn strategies for setting limits and enforcing the new rules, refer to Chapter 5. Once Noah began falling asleep quickly and easily, moving his bedtime earlier again would be an option. Noah's parents were successful on all counts. Bedtime began to go smoothly. Soon they moved it 30 minutes earlier, and Noah fell asleep quickly. He was napping again, and he was now getting enough sleep on a regular and predictable schedule. He had stopped testing limits at bedtime, and when he started to wake at night, he was no longer being overstimulated by his parents' well-meaning attempts to help. His nighttime partial waking soon grew much rarer and milder, and over the next month or so, they disappeared almost completely. Christopher, 8, had been having abnormal nighttime wakings for almost 2 years. His sleep problems had started 2 months after his father's death, when he and his mother moved to a new neighborhood. He began walking in his sleep 2 or 3 times a week, calmly and quietly, without crying, talking, or showing any signs of agitation. He would have what his mother described as a strange look on his face, and he wouldn't always respond to her questions. Usually he appeared to be wandering aimlessly, but sometimes he seemed to be looking for something. Although he seemed not to recognize his mother, he would allow her to lead him back to bed, usually after a stop in the bathroom to urinate. On 2 occasions he urinated in his room, once into the wastebasket and once into his closet. Twice he walked out of the house and was led back home by neighbors. These episodes continued unchanged for a year, through several stressful periods. His mother was away for 2 weeks for emergency surgery, and shortly after that she remarried, and his family moved again. Then his mother became pregnant. Shortly before the birth of his sister, Christopher's nighttime episodes changed. They now occurred several times a night, and they followed a new pattern. About an hour after falling asleep, Christopher would sit up suddenly and cry out briefly, appearing frightened. He would not respond to his mother, he resisted being touched, and he muttered incoherently off and on throughout the episodes. He would calm down in a few minutes, at which point he could be coaxed to lie back down in bed and would fall asleep rapidly. The episode would repeat itself an hour later, and again an hour after that. After the third episode, he would begin to walk about the house in his sleep, as he had when he was younger, but now in a more agitated manner. His mother and stepfather couldn't understand why these things were happening, and since their own sleep was constantly being interrupted, they were resentful and angry about his behavior. Christopher was a quiet, pleasant youngster, but he seemed tense and anxious. I learned that both his late father and his stepfather were alcoholics, and that his family had some trouble with domestic violence. He was angry at the people around him, but he was afraid to express those feelings. He was also frightened by his lack of control over the world around him, and he was no doubt distraught that his parents could not control themselves. He devoted much of his energy to rigid self-control, worried that if he did not control his feelings, his parents would become even angrier and possibly increase his punishments. Christopher and his mother both needed counseling, which they began separately on my recommendation. In the meantime, I explained the details of nighttime arousals to his mother and stepfather so they wouldn't be so angry at him. To keep him from leaving the house again in his sleep, I suggested a lock high up on the front door. Given Christopher's ability to hurt himself while sleepwalking, and because his mother and stepfather were not yet able to be supportive, I also chose to prescribe medication to control his partial arousals, at least until his counseling had progressed. With a small dose of clonazepam taken before bed, his nighttime arousals disappeared almost completely. Meanwhile, in counseling, he was allowed to express his fears and concerns in a safe and supportive setting, and his mother began to learn how to listen to him in a sympathetic, non-judgmental way. He became happier, more relaxed, and less fearful. After 6 months, Christopher and his mother had made real progress in therapy, and tensions had eased at home, so we gradually stopped his medication. Some nighttime arousals returned, but they were milder now. His sleepwalking was no longer agitated, and often instead of sleepwalking at all, he merely sat up in bed. Instead of screaming, he would only talk softly. The episodes were much less frequent than before, never happening more than once a night, and his mother now knew how to deal with them without getting angry. They diminished even further over the next several months, and by the time he was 9, they occurred only occasionally. Maria's nighttime arousals were still more dramatic than Christopher's, falling somewhere between angry, agitated sleepwalking and full sleep terrors. At age 12, she had been having them for just over 3 years. About an hour and a half after going to sleep, she would sit up and let out a single, long, guttural scream. Then she would get out of bed and run about frantically, fumbling along walls and furniture as if trying blindly to escape a burning room. Sometimes she would fall to the floor and thrash, kick, and roll around. Occasionally she ran wildly out of her room and even down the stairs. Although weeks sometimes passed between Maria's episodes, more often they happened once or twice a week. Sometimes she seemed frightened. Other times she seemed angry, frantic, and confused. She pushed people away when they tried to restrain her, and when spoken to, she responded with apparent anger, replying, "Go away," or "Leave me alone." Once or twice she tried unsuccessfully to leave the house. Occasionally she had milder episodes, during which she sat up in bed, talking, and showed few signs of agitation. Her mother had discovered that she could trigger an episode by disturbing Maria's sleep in any way, between 60 and 90 minutes after Maria had fallen asleep. She had learned to stay out of Maria's room at those times, not even trying to cover her with a blanket. Maria had not had any major problems during sleepovers at friends' homes, but the possibility worried her mother. When Maria was 9, her confusional episodes had lasted as long as half an hour, but now at age 12, most of them ended within 5 or 10 minutes. As an episode ended, she would grow calm, wake up enough to use the bathroom, and go back to sleep. Her parents often let her spend the rest of the night in their room. Some mornings they found her sleeping in their room, but neither they nor Maria knew when she had come in. Maria herself had no memory of any of the events, either immediately after they occurred or in the morning. Maria's family tried to be supportive, but her parents were preoccupied with their own marital problems, which they were working on with the help of a marriage counselor. Maria had recently started seeing a psychologist, too. She did not seem to have any striking emotional problems, and she was extremely well-behaved, at least away from home. However, she was not an outgoing youngster. She was angry at her parents over the strained mood at home and what she experienced as a lack of warmth and nurturance. She had difficulty expressing these feelings, and she was afraid that if she did express them, it would only make matters worse. I was able to reassure Maria's parents that she was physically normal, as are most children who have confusional events at night, and that arousals like hers were common. They were relieved to learn that we could stop the episodes with medication, but since the episodes were brief and occurred early in the night while they were still awake, we decided not to put Maria on a regular prescription. It would always be available when she was sleeping away from home, or if the episodes worsened. I also suggested that Maria sleep in her own room all night, every night. If she never found it necessary to change rooms and always knew where she was when she woke up, some of the causes of the arousals would likely go away. Her parents put a chair by their door so that if she came into their room, they would hear her and could guide her back to her own bed. Our hope was that as Maria continued to work with her psychologist, as she got out of the habit of switching rooms, and as her parents continued to resolve their own problems, her wakings would gradually become rarer and less severe. In fact, they did diminish significantly over the next several months. David was 17. Over the 8 years before I met him, his parents had divorced and both had remarried. Before their separation, David was known to talk in his sleep frequently. That was the extent of his nighttime arousals until he was 12, when his father remarried. Then they started to show more severe variations. About once a month, around midnight, he would suddenly leap out of bed and begin yelling. His mother would find him standing in his room, apparently upset and looking, she said, as if he was worried that something was going to happen to him. He did not seem to be actually frightened, although he occasionally mumbled cryptic phrases like, "I've got to get him." When David was 15, his mother remarried as well, and his arousals became even more intense. Now they began with what his mother described as a blood-curdling scream, after which David would jump out of bed, knock over furniture, and run about as if trying to escape from something. In these episodes, he appeared truly terrified. He injured himself a few times, although mostly he got away with minor scrapes and bruises. Once he broke a window pane and cut his hand. On another occasion, he leaned dangerously out an open window in his room on the second floor. He woke fully at the end of each episode, embarrassed to find himself in a room in disarray with his family staring at him. David's parents described him as very controlled, with a tendency to hold things in and handle things too well. He seemed not to be working to the best of his ability in school. I found him pleasant and cooperative, but he seemed somewhat depressed. He was easy to talk to, and in fact he was able to express many of his feelings, though he was clearly not fully aware of all of them, particularly those involving sadness and anger. Although David's partial arousals were infrequent, they were so severe that I feared he might seriously injure himself. I have treated adolescents who have jumped out of windows during episodes like his. I placed David on medication that effectively stopped the arousals, but that was only a stopgap to ensure his safety. We wanted him sleeping calmly and safely without drugs. Even apart from any impact on his sleep, his mild depression, suppressed anger, and unsatisfactory school performance all needed attention. For these reasons, I recommended psychotherapy. David and his family followed through on this suggestion, and he profited enormously. Over time, I watched him emerge from his shell and become a happier young man and a more successful student. After several months, we considered stopping the medication. Because his nighttime arousals had been potentially dangerous, I reduced his prescription slowly and carefully, watching for recurrences at each step. By the time he left for college, he had been off medication altogether for several months, but I asked his family to be sure he had a roommate to report the recurrence of any problems. The medication would always be available if it became necessary again. Chapter 14. Nightmares. What nightmares are and why they occur. Nightmares are dreams, very scary dreams that wake you and leave you frightened and full of dread. A nightmare begins as an ordinary dream, but then toward the end it turns frightening. A child might dream he is happily walking his dog in the park on a sunny day. Then it suddenly gets dark. He finds he is lost in the woods, and a monster jumps at him, and he wakes frightened. When we speak of nightmares, we're concerned with dreams that are frightening enough to wake your child. Most dreams, even scary ones, are forgotten.